Good evening. Good morning. We're entering the fourth chapter in the second book of the Life Divine tonight. It's entitled The Divine and the Undivine. By the time we reach the end of the last chapter, The Eternal and the Individual, we saw that Sri Aurobindo founds his philosophy on the principle of being, a real conscious being whose nature is delight. Being is the basis, and the consciousness of this being manifests, makes clear from within its own potentiality the universe. It's not that he rubs his hands together and twinkles his eye and dashes something and says, aha, now there's a universe. He brings the universe out of his own being, if you want to use the term he. Why does he make the universe stand forth? For the play of delight. If that's true, and if we can experience that truth in the depths of our psychological and spiritual being, how do we reconcile it with the apparent darkness of the world? And this is what Sri Aurobindo is going to grapple with now in this chapter, The Divine and the Undivine, but in chapters to come. The next is called The Cosmic Illusion. The sixth is Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. And the seventh chapter is The Knowledge and the Ignorance. So this idea of darkness here and light there, if you want to say there, is something that we must deal with thoroughly. So we're going to have virtually 100 pages of this. You will know this philosophy thoroughly by the time we finish. He begins with a focus on the Supreme in these mottos, these citations from Vedantic sources. Three Upanishads are cited here, the Isha, the Katha, the Kena, and also the Bhagavad Gita. So the first citation, the seer, Kavi, the thinker, Manishin, the self-existent, Swayambhu, who becomes everywhere, has ordered perfectly all things from years sempiternal. Who becomes everywhere, that's an interesting translation. Paribhu is the Sanskrit term, which we would normally say is encompassing, all gathering, a being which is in all things. This again, the Isha Upanishad, foundational to Sri Aurobindo's view. Remember that his first philosophic treatment of the Isha Upanishad, long before there was a journal Arya, long before the ashram came into being, was called the Life Divine, because it is a positive view of the universe. So this first citation is from its eighth verse. So the being who creates is a great seer, a kavi, thinks things out, in other words, has mastery of the intricate details and principles which would be necessary to manifestation, and does not have to look for another to aid or assist or to give permission, but manifests the entire universe from within himself because he is self-existent. And his ordering of things is perfect. There is no flaw. Well, what do our eyes see when they look at things? Appearances, perhaps not the depth that this great rishi has who wrote the issue of Upanishad. So the creator, or the manifester, herself, himself, itself, is a seer who is master of all the principles of being. The next citation is from the Gita. Many, purified by knowledge, have come to my state of being. Purified putta, by knowledge, jnana tapasa, gone through this great austerity to build knowledge, have broken through the appearances and have arrived at essential being, have come, agata, to my state of being, madbhavam. Wonderful term that recurs in the Gita. So we're invited into a profound communion and oneness with the Supreme Divine, who brings us sedulously through our spiritual growth into the full knowledge, i.e. oneness with him, identity of being with greater being. And in that we find completeness. That was from the fourth chapter. The completion of that citation is from the 14th, towards the end of the Gita. They have reached likeness in their law of being to me, sadharmyam, having the same dharma, the same operating principles. So it's not simply an essential identity, but the law of the being, not just sheer being, but the law means how the being governs itself, which implies manifestation and ordering of the universe. When we rise to a state of complete communion with that Supreme, put on that nature, we participate in a sense in the governance of the universe. We become co-agents with the Supreme. The third citation is from the Kena. Know that, tat, for the Brahman, and not this which men cherish here or worship here, upasate. So we're racing after all sorts of goods which we will pile up on the gross physical plane, which will abandon us, or we will abandon them, because you can't own anything. That is not what the spiritual seeker seeks. He seeks this Brahman, and that is the thing that we find in our deep experience. If we find it not, we have no bliss. We have pleasure, we have pain, we have indifference, neutrality. We do not have ananda. The last citation is again... I've skipped one. I want to get to the kata, pardon me. One controlling inner self of all beings. The one controller is the ikovashi. The inner self of all beings is sarva bhuta antaratman. One controlling inner self of all beings. Harkens later to the Bhagavad Gita, which says a very similar thing. As the sun, the eye of the world, is not touched by the external faults of vision, so this inner self in beings is not touched by the sorrow of the world. The sun shines freely from above, and whatever play of shadows there may be here, that is not the sun's experience of itself. The sorrow of the world, loka dukena. Katha Upanishad, loka dukena, must be around the time that the Buddha was formulating his Eightfold Path. So, the idea of a world of suffering. Well, you can see that the Upanishads perceive that point, the justice in that partial view, but that is not where they sit. They push farther. And the Gita sounds here a note that is in consonance with the Katha Upanishad. The Lord abides in the heart of all beings. So, if in the midst of Sri Aurobindo's exposition of the life divine, he has arrived at an insight that philosophy, through its principal tool of logic, cannot be the arbiter of truth because it is not wide enough, deep enough to assess what is truth, to follow the trail of phenomena to their origin. So logic must not arrest us, and the tools of logic are not the highest tools for a philosophic vision. It is possible to base a spiritual philosophy on something greater than the mind. Reason may assist, reason must not dictate. But that deep psychological experience, which is the foundation of his philosophy and his articulation of the life divine and its possibility, must reach reality as it is. And this, of course, is the business, the duty, the mission of the real seer, the rishi, the kavi. Let's begin. The universe is a manifestation of an infinite and eternal all existence. The divine being dwells in all that is. We ourselves are that in ourself, in our own deepest being. Our soul, the secret indwelling psychic entity, is a portion of the divine consciousness and essence. So, again, he establishes a transcendence, the home of real being, and all existence, though, not simply a transcendence, because it also expresses itself cosmically, universally. And we aspiring individuals who struggle out of ignorance towards knowledge, have a secret to our existence. It is a psychic entity. There is a soul within us, which is not simply part of the play of phenomena, is not the ego subject to dissolution, but is eternal in its core. It is a portion of the divine consciousness and essence. So, cognate with the Supreme, a partner with the universe in the divine's play here. This, he says, is the view we have taken of our existence. But at the same time, we speak of a divine life as the culmination of the evolutionary process. And the use of the phrase implies that our present life is undivine, and all the life, too, that is below us. At the first glance, this looks like a self-contradiction. Instead of making a distinction between the divine life we aspire for and a present undivine existence, it would be more logical to speak of an ascent from level to higher level of a divine manifestation. It may be admitted that essentially, if we look at the inner reality alone and discount the suggestions of the outer figure, Such might be the nature of the evolution, the change we have to undergo in nature. So it would appear, perhaps, to the impartial eye of a universal vision untroubled by our dualities of knowledge and ignorance, good and evil, happiness and suffering, and participating in the untrammeled consciousness and delight of Satchit-Ananda. And yet, from the practical and relative point of view, as distinguished from an essential vision, the distinction between the divine and the undivine has an insistent value, a very pressing significance. This, then, is an aspect of the problem which it is necessary to bring into the light and assess its true importance. The distinction between the divine and the undivine life is, in fact, identical with the root distinction between a life of knowledge lived in self-awareness and in the power of the light and a life of ignorance. At any rate, it so presents itself in a world that is slowly and with difficulty evolving out of an original inconscience. Again, some chapters from now, there'll be an entire section devoted to the knowledge and the ignorance. All life that has still this inconscience for its basis is stamped with the mark of a radical imperfection. For even if it is satisfied with its own type, it is a satisfaction with something incomplete and inharmonious, a patchwork of discords. On the contrary, even a purely mental or vital life might be perfect within its limits if it were based on a restricted but harmonious self-power and self-knowledge. It is this bondage to a perpetual stamp of imperfection and disharmony that is the mark of the undivine. A divine life, on the contrary, even if progressing from the little to the more, would be at each stage harmonious in its principle and detail. It would be a secure ground upon which freedom and perfection could naturally flower or grow towards their highest stature, refine and expand into their most subtle opulence. All imperfections, all perfections, have to be taken into view in our consideration of the difference between an undivine and a divine existence. But ordinarily, when we make the distinction, we do it as human beings struggling under the pressure of life and the difficulties of our conduct amidst its immediate problems and perplexities. Most of all, we are thinking of the distinction we are obliged to make between good and evil, or of that along with its kindred problem of the duality, the blend in us of happiness and suffering. When we seek intellectually for a divine presence in things, a divine origin of the world, a divine government of its workings, the presence of evil, the insistence on suffering, the large, the enormous part offered to pain, grief, and affliction in the economy of nature, are the cruel phenomena which baffle our reason and overcome the instinctive faith of mankind in such an origin and government, or in an all-seeing, all-determining, and omnipresent divine immanence. So, this contradiction between the ideal divine life as the mind would envision it and the perpetual limitation and disappointment of life as we actually experience it are at loggerheads, must be reconciled. This experience of good and evil, of pain and suffering, this is our immediate outrage. This stops us in the quest for spiritual philosophy simply on the face of it. We cannot accept that as a final position. But phenomena seem to deny this essence of being, which we have asserted is the foundation of the universe. To continue, other difficulties we could solve more easily and happily, and make some shift to be better satisfied with the ready conclusiveness of our solutions. But this standard of judgment is not sufficiently comprehensive, and it is supported upon a too human point of view. For to a wider outlook, evil and suffering appear only as a striking aspect. They are not the whole defect, not even the root of the matter. So he's revisiting here the theodicy that he has spoken about in earlier chapters, this examination of the nature of suffering and evil. Why is it here in the world? Delight of existence, the problem. Delight of existence, the solution. Those early chapters in the first book dealt with that. And if you remember, called us to see more largely, that we cannot, from our limited egoistic experience, just not even a drop in the ocean of universal life, could understand all that is being conducted in the universe and see, feel, know for a certainty that this universal being who dwells also in us, who has become all of this, is itself undertaking to bear and support and encourage and nurture all through the apparent evil and suffering, so that we can move through good and evil, lowercase, and arrive at a greater good, uppercase. But theodicy has come back to the life divine, and here we are. We have to develop this vast and penetrating vision to be able to understand why there is suffering here, and what it means, and who is it indeed who suffers. The sum of the world's imperfections is not made up only of these two deficiencies. There is more than the fall, if fall there was, of our spiritual or material being from good and from happiness, or our nature's failure to overcome evil and suffering. Besides the deficiency of the ethical and hedonistic satisfactions demanded by our being, the paucity of good and delight in our world experience, there is also the deficiency of other divine degrees. For knowledge, truth, beauty, power, unity are, they too, the stuff and elements of a divine life. And these are given to us in a scanty and grudging measure. Yet all are in their absolute powers of the divine nature. So in our sensational experience of things, we withdraw with horror from the experience of pain, suffering. We abhor evil. But it is not simply the experience of delight, that delight Ananda wishes to experience in the universe, but more than that, expressions of knowledge, truth, beauty, power, unity are also aspects of that one truth, Satchit Ananda. He continues, it is not possible then to limit the description of our and the world's undivine imperfection solely to moral evil or sensational suffering. There is more in the world enigma than their double problem, for they are only two strong results of a common principle. It is the general principle of imperfection that we have to admit and consider. So he wants us to get to a higher level, to see with a more Olympian view, if you will. If we look closely at this general imperfection, we shall see that it consists first in a limitation in us of the divine elements, which robs them of their divinity, then in a various many-branching distortion, a perversion, a contrary turn, a falsifying departure from some ideal truth of being. So first we come upon a division, and that initial limitation has radical consequences which flow from that. To our minds, which do not possess that truth but can conceive it, this departure presents itself either as a state from which we have lapsed spiritually, or as a possibility or promise which we cannot fulfill, cannot realize, because it exists only as an ideal. There has been either a lapse of the inner spirit from a greater consciousness and knowledge, delight, love, and beauty, power and capacity, harmony and good, or else there is a failure of our struggling nature, an impotence to achieve what we instinctively see to be divine and desirable. So this would be the view of a mental philosophy and intellectual perspective, seeing that there's a failure to be powerfully what we are in essence. If we penetrate to the cause of the fall or the failure, we shall find that all proceeds from the one primal fact that our being, consciousness, force, experience of things represent, not in their very self, but in their surface pragmatic nature, a principle or an effective phenomenon of division or rupture in the unity of the divine existence. So this again echoes a theme developed in earlier chapters. This division becomes, in its inevitable practical effect, a limitation of the divine consciousness and knowledge, the divine delight and beauty, the divine power and capacity, the divine harmony and good. There is a limitation of completeness and wholeness, a blindness in our vision of these things, a lameness in our following of them, in our experience of them, a fragmentation, a diminution of power and intensity, a lowering of quality, the mark of a descent from spiritual heights, or else of a consciousness emerging from the insensible, neutral monotone of the inconscience. The intensities which are normal and natural on higher ranges are in us lost or toned down so as to harmonize with the grays and blacks of our material existence. So limited, we sense, we taste, we experience only a part of the universe, having, for some mysterious reason, left our true being above and moved into a divided and limited sphere. And all the range of our consciousness, all the possible experiences available to us, how we extend ourselves in expression and engaging the world about us, suffer because of that initial limitation of our being. There arises, too, he says, by a secondary ulterior effect, a perversion of these highest things. In our limited mentality, unconsciousness and wrong consciousness intervene. Ignorance covers our whole nature and, by the misapplication or misdirection of an imperfect will and knowledge, by automatic reactions of our diminished consciousness force and the inept poverty of our substance, contradictions of the divine elements are formed. Incapacity, inertia, falsehood, error, pain and grief, wrongdoing, discord, evil. So he describes here the chain of events that flow from this first division of being within greater being, of us abandoning our high nature and admitting ourselves into the chambers of the low. There is, too, always, somewhere hidden in ourselves, nursed in our recesses, even when not overtly felt in the conscious nature, even when rejected by the parts of us which these things torture, an attachment to this experience of division, a clinging to the divided way of being which prevents the excision of these unhappinesses or their rejection and removal. So, dark we have become, and dark we love. We grasp it. We don't want to leave it. We are happy in our prison. Lord Byron, the prisoner of Chillon. For since the principle of consciousness, force, and ananda is at the root of all manifestation, nothing can endure if it has not a will in our nature, a sanction of the purusha, a sustained pleasure in some part of the being, even though it be a secret or a perverse pleasure, to keep it in continuance. So there is some deep sanction of delight, capital D, present here in the universal game. A meaning, a postponed deliciousness in the apparent discord, which is dissimilar to the I from the divine nature. He says, when we say that all is a divine manifestation, even that which we call undivine, we mean that in its essentiality, all is divine, even if the form baffles or repels us. Or to put it in a formula to which it is easier for our psychological sense of things to give its assent, in all things there is a presence, a primal reality, the self, the divine Brahman, which is forever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite. Its infinity is not affected by the limitations of relative things. Its purity is not stained by our sin and evil. Its bliss is not touched by our pain and suffering. Its perfection is not impaired by our defects of consciousness, knowledge, will, unity. In certain images of the Upanishads, the divine Purusha is described as the one fire which has entered into all forms and shapes itself according to the form, as the one sun which illumines all impartially and is not affected by the faults of our seeing. In fact, these are citations which open the chapter. But this affirmation is not enough. It leaves the problem unsolved. Why that which is in itself, ever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite, should not only tolerate, but seem to maintain and encourage in its manifestation imperfection and limitation, impurity and suffering and falsehood and evil. It states the duality that constitutes the problem, but does not solve it. This is, in a sense, a challenge back to the Upanishads, simply declaring that all is the divine, and that the divine has entered into all things here, is the substance of our spiritual experience. But we are left with this conflict at the level of mental acuity as to how to resolve this. Philosophy attempts, again, spiritual philosophy attempts more, but we must rise to a vision that truly synthesizes them all, that brings all together, founded upon the essence, so that we can see how in the principles of nature's operations, its very laws or consciously directed by that supreme force. If we simply leave these two dissonant facts of existence standing in each other's presence, we are driven to conclude that there is no reconciliation possible. All we can do is to cling as much as we can to a deepening sense of the joy of the pure and essential presence and do the best we may with the discordant externality until we can impose in its place the law of its divine contrary. This would be the position of reason, or psychologically freed, we are still unable in intellectual terms to understand the universe, but we remain satisfied within. Or else, he writes, we have to seek for an escape rather than a solution. For we can say that the inner presence alone is a truth and the discordant externality is a falsehood or illusion created by a mysterious principle of ignorance. Advaita Vedanta. Our problem is to find some way of escape out of the falsehood of the manifested world into the truth of the hidden reality. So for Sri Aurobindo, this exit into a moksha, which resolves into an absolute Brahman but leaves the world as it was, seems to be only an illusion. Why deal with it? Abandon it. Seek rather this highest status and exist in it only. And he continues, or we may hold with the Buddhist that there is no need of explanation, since there is this one practical fact of the imperfection and impermanence of things, and no self, divine or Brahman, for that too is an illusion of our consciousness. The one thing that is necessary for liberation is to get rid of the persistent structure of ideas and persistent energy of action, which maintain a continuity in the flux of the impermanence. That would be the causative aspect, which chains us to the apparent phenomena of existence. On this road of escape, he says, we achieve self-extinction in nirvana. The problem of things gets itself extinguished by our own self-extinction. This is a way out. But it does not look like the true and only way, nor are the other solutions altogether satisfactory. It is a fact that by excluding the discordant manifestation from our inner consciousness as a superficial externality, by insisting only on the pure and perfect presence, we can achieve individually a deep and blissful sense of this silent divinity, can enter into the sanctuary, can live in the light and the rapture. An exclusive inner concentration on the real, the eternal, is possible. Even a self-immersion by which we can lose or put away the dissonances of the universe. So, it is possible for that drop to join that ocean. There is more. But there is, too, somewhere deep down in us, the need of a total consciousness. There is in nature a secret universal seeking for the whole divine, an impulsion towards some entire awareness and delight and power of existence. This need of a whole being, a total knowledge, this integral will in us is not fully satisfied by these solutions. So long as the world is not divinely explained to us, the divine remains imperfectly known. For the world, too, is that, and so long as it is not present to our consciousness and possessed by our powers of consciousness in the sense of the divine being, we are not in possession of the whole divinity. So he demands that we recognize that nature herself is adamant about achieving this larger synthetic consciousness founded on a true knowledge to absorb all these disparate views and arrive at something greater. We know already what he is aiming at, but we'll get to it segment by segment. So let me pause to mention, if I might for a moment, that we'll place our bookmarks here and come back to the Life Divine shortly. But for the next three Sundays, I'll be absent from Pensacola. I'll be in Pondicherry, my other spiritual home. And it won't be possible to gain a broadband connection secure enough to be able to have our Zoom meetings. So what we've decided is that our group in Pensacola will continue to meet on Sundays, as always we do, and we'll meet again on Zoom on the 17th of April. And I'll send out a note reminding all that we'll be absent for these three Sundays. I apologize for that. Apologize for the interruption. And we'll gather on the 17th and again on the 24th, which is a Darshan day. Probably do some work in the Life Divine on that day too, because we'll have to catch up our pace. The group here in Pensacola will be reading some of the Mother's talks on the Life Divine. Perhaps you've seen them in Volume 9 of her collected works. But they'll be going through this in a rotational reading, self-led group. And you're welcome to join them. I think they'll be working in a book that looks like this, if you can see it. It's called, let's see if I can bend it. There we go. The Life Divine, The Mother's Talks. And it's a collection of all those from Volume 9. And they'll be working, I think, in the second, third, and fourth chapters. They're relatively short, but they'll be reading those along. So I thank you for your patience. Again, I apologize for the interruption. I will miss seeing you, and I will miss seeing all of you. Maybe we can arrange, if I can get a secure broadband connection, for at least a quick hello from Pondicherry to you all. We'll see about that. We've been reading about the divine and the undivine. Let's turn to Savitri. This is in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 8, The World of Falsehood. In atomic parcelings of the infinite, near to the dumb beginnings of lost self, he felt the curious small futility of the creation of material things. Or, stifled in the inconscient's hollow dusk, he sounded the mystery dark and bottomless of the enormous and unmeaning deeps whence struggling life in a dead universe rose. There, in the stark identity lost by mind, he felt the sealed sense of the insensible world and a mute wisdom in the unknowing night. Into the abysmal secrecy he came, where darkness peers from her mattress, gray and nude, and stood on the last locked subconscious floor, where being slept unconscious of its thoughts and built the world not knowing what it built. There waiting its hour, the future lay unknown. There is the record of the vanished stars. There in the slumber of the cosmic will, he saw the secret key of nature's change. A light was with him, an invisible hand was laid upon the error and the pain, till it became a quivering ecstasy, the shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace. He saw in night the eternal's shadowy veil, new death for a cellar of the house of life. In destruction felt creation's hasty pace, new loss as the price of a celestial gain, and hell as a shortcut to heaven's gates. Then in illusion's occult factory, and in the inconscient's magic printing house, torn were the formats of the primal night, and shattered the stereotypes of ignorance. Alive, breathing a deep spiritual breath, nature expunged her stiff mechanical code and the articles of the bound soul's contract. Falsehood gave back to truth her tortured shape. Annulled were the tables of the law of pain, and in their place grew luminous characters. The skillful penman's unseen finger wrote his swift, intuitive calligraphy. Earth's forms were made his divine documents. The wisdom embodied mind could not reveal, inconscience chased from the world's voiceless breast. Transfigured were the fixed schemes of reasoning thought. Arousing consciousness in things inert, he imposed upon dark atom and dumb mass the diamond script of the imperishable, inscribed on the dim heart of fallen things, a paean song of the free infinite and the name, foundation of eternity, and traced on the awake, exultant cells in the ideographs of the ineffable, the lyric of the love that waits through time, and the mystic volume of the Book of Bliss, and the message of the superconscient fire. Then life beat pure in the corporeal frame. The infernal gleam died and could slay no more. Hell split across its huge, abrupt facade, as if a magic building were undone. Night opened and vanished like a gulf of dream. Into being's gap scooped out as empty space in which he had filled the place of absent God, there poured a wide, intimate, and blissful dawn. Healed were all things that time's torn heart had made, and sorrow could live no more in nature's breast. Division ceased to be, for God was there. The soul lit the conscious body with its ray. Matter and spirit mingled and were one. End of Canto 8. And with your permission, I take you with me to Pondicherry. And with your permission, I leave something of myself here with you. Love to you all. Namaste. Jai Ma.